The next case set for argument is Robert and Melissa Hood et al. Versus Clyde and Nancy Stratmeyer. Courtney Claiborne is arguing on behalf of the appellants and is present in the courtroom. Talbot Wazorik and Keely Clevin are here on behalf of Appalese, and Mr. Wazorik will be arguing, I understand. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument and then a five-minute rebuttal. I'm a little bit messed up because don't we normally have them switch? Are we switched around in this case, Shirley? Am I thinking wrong? No? Okay. It's really messing me up, but that's okay. We'll still have Mr. Claiborne go first. Go ahead, Mr. Claiborne.
Chief Justice, good morning, and if it pleases the court, counsel. I had a 50-50 chance of getting the right table and I blew it, so that's on me. Good morning. It's my pleasure to be before you today representing the appellants who are the homeowners in the Shadowlands subdivision, which is a subdivision in Meade County, South Dakota. That subdivision has been, since its inception, covered by a set of covenants that these individuals have followed. At some point in time, towards the end of our prior to the litigation, a lot was subdivided in violation of the covenants, and that was done through the city of Somerset. Important to note, this subdivision is not in the city of Somerset, so there was no notice provided to the actual owners of the subdivision. The defendants in Appalese, in this case, the Stratmeyers, did go through Meade County and obtained a building permit. That building permit process required that they make certain representations, including the fact that they had reviewed and were aware of the covenants. In trial, it became apparent that they had not reviewed, nor were they aware of the covenants at the time they bought the lot or at the time they moved to start building their home. Myself on behalf of the appellants, decided to start a declaratory judgment action as being the most expeditious and probably easiest way to bring this matter before the court. The reasoning there being that the declaratory judgment action allows you to get at least some idea of your status prior to incurring the harm, which is beneficial to both parties because the defendants wouldn't have started their construction, the plaintiffs wouldn't have gone through a process of setting aside the rezoning of the lot if the covenants were in fact deemed to not be valid. So it's kind of the theory of there's little point defusing the second bomb if you don't do the first bomb. So if the covenants are invalid, then everything else can stay in place without cost to the parties.
Let me ask this, Mr. Claiborne. You've got a number of individuals you're representing in the court. Trial court found some of those individuals had violated the covenants themselves, made that finding. Are you disputing those findings as to any or all of those individuals?
We are, Your Honor, as to all of those individuals. And that's probably an excellent place to start. The ruling of the court has, in essence, made covenants a living document, and especially as they pertain to housing developments. So in other words, these owners of these lots have followed these covenants to the letter that they believe they existed for years. You have a new set of owners that walk in, and actually after the fact, if we're honest, they decide, hey, we know we've violated the covenants, so we're going to find out how you violated the covenants. And in order to do so, they have to now say, well, these are ambiguous. And so when I talk about making covenants a living document, what this means is if they are allowed to prevail on that theory, then anytime somebody wanted to get rid of covenants, all you have to do is sell your lot, have the new person come in and allege a violation or an ambiguity. And so with respect to the plaintiffs here, the appellants, there are four basic covenants which the court addressed and determined there were violations. The first one was there shall be only one single-family dwelling per lot with no larger than a three-car garage. Now, the individuals that have lived here have built outbuildings, some with garages, some with storage, just different things. And the court says, well, this is a covenant violation because you've built these other buildings. The covenants don't prevent that. And to create an ambiguity, the court had to go out of the way to say, well, the three-car garage means you can only have a three-car garage. You can't have anything else. But that's not reading this sentence in full, which says there shall only be one single-family dwelling with no larger than a three-car garage. So the garage is literally and figuratively attached to the dwelling.
Of course, you didn't read the per lot language that comes in between those two phrases, and is that seemed to be, the court found ambiguity with regard to the term car, didn't it?
It did, which I was quite frankly confused on how that was interpreted, because not all the outbuildings are for cars, but...
It appears you aren't disputing the court's ultimate determination that the size of the stall is not limited to a smaller type vehicle that we would typically refer to as a car.
Correct. I am not disputing that. What we are speaking to is the court determined you can only have one garage.
You think the court was correct in that there was ambiguity as to that term, but you're suggesting there's not ambiguity as to how the rest of that phrase is interpreted? I just want to understand what your argument is there.
My argument would be that there is no ambiguity to this. This sentence read as a whole allows you a single family dwelling on your lot with no larger than a three-car garage. It doesn't prohibit the construction of anything else. To take the court's interpretation, then you would say, well, it doesn't say you can have a swimming pool, so you can't have a swimming pool. It doesn't say you can construct a shed, so you can't have a shed. So it's not, and remembering that covenants are strictly construed for free use of your lot.
And I think I understand your argument with regard to the garage issue. If we could turn to the boundary issue, and is it your position that you don't, that there is no ambiguity in that provision also?
Correct.
It seemed that your argument was relying upon testimony from a witness, from the developer at trial. And so so my question is, if it's not ambiguous, is it appropriate then? Or you seem to be arguing on that as extrinsic evidence to support your view of how that should be interpreted?
On the boundary issue, the lots are on the plat. They are defined. They have boundaries. All the homeowners pay the taxes from corner to corner. They understand, and they're required, that they understand that there is access easements on their property, but that they're responsible to maintain that portion of their property that the public is allowed to travel for ingress and egress. Since the inception, these houses have been constructed with using that as the boundary. And on the maps, it's the boundary. And it only didn't become the boundary when this lot was sold and subdivided and somebody needed a reason to have a covenant violation. Still through today, these roads are privately maintained. The homeowners are responsible for that 33 feet that's on their lot. They have to shovel it and keep it clean. And again, they're paying the taxes on it.
Is that a legal question or a question of fact where the boundary is?
I think it's a factual determination because there's a plat that has Exhibit 17 specifically shows you the boundary, and it goes to the middle of the road. And if you'll look, all the outbuildings, all the construction, with the exception, there's one that I believe it's like a sprinkler, small building, a sprinkler system. All the buildings are constructed within that 40 feet. And that's been the treatment of this since the inception until, again, somebody sells the lot and it's brought up as an ambiguity. Before this, it was not ambiguous. The homeowners have all lived by the same code of conduct. Nobody's ever question that the boundaries were what you're responsible for and what you paid taxes on.
I thought, did I just hear you say you do think there is now an ambiguity?
No. The ambiguity only arises because the defendants in this case says this is ambiguous. Before, and I believe still through now, your boundary is your boundary. What do I pay taxes on? What does my legal description say? What's my title say? And it goes from the center of the street through the other boundary, the outside boundary of your lot. And I don't think that's ambiguous. And again, if it is, then that ambiguity needs to be resolved in favor of the full use of your property. And it would be not only, I don't think, legally correct, but not equitably correct to require that the owners have to have the burden of maintaining this entire lot. But then for purposes of this argument, you say, well, but we're going to shave off that 33 feet so somebody can say you're violating the covenants that you guys all understood you to be in compliance with. The other one I'd like to address would be the business, the residential. There's a provision that says the lot shall be used for residential purposes only, and lot owners shall conduct no business activities which requires extra parking facilities. That's what the statement says. Here the trial court found that two of the owners who have jobs outside of this development, but one was a construction company, one is a tree service, they park vehicles on their lot and one allowed an employee to park there, and that somehow constitutes business activity which required extra parking facilities, which is not true. In both those instances, both of those individuals testified that they bought their lots as is, they maintained the driveways, both have rather large driving surfaces or parking surfaces that are maintained by adding gravel, doing things that normal people living in rural areas would do. They're not conducting business. None of them actually have customers coming to the house doing things that we would normally associate with business. And the court, we believe, incorrectly found on a question of fact that those activities of parking vehicles in your lot or letting your employees park there while you go to a job site constitutes business activities which require extra parking. Not a scintilla of evidence that anybody's done anything to enlarge or improve parking for the purpose of servicing business customers. Finally, there's the boundary 40 feet issue came into play again on the what's a building. So there's sheds that have been moved onto the property and things of that nature, lean-tos that have been moved on or constructed, temporary structures, if you will, and the court found those to be buildings within the definition of the covenants themselves. And we would offer to this court that there's only one permanent building that was identified within that 40 feet, and that would be one of the homeowners has a rather small structure that houses their sprinkler system. That in our argument and opinion, would be a technical violation at best, and something, if were ordered to be removed, could do so without any hardship to the landowners.
And then, Mr. Claiborne, there's some of these nine, I think it's nine landowners, lot owners, that the court didn't find had violated the covenants at all. Am I correct about that?
Correct.
Two lot owners?
I'm sorry?
Two lot owners that did not violate any of the covenants?
I believe that is correct in terms of the count. And then, like I point out the larger issue for the appellants in this case would be how are these going to change for the next persons or people who sell and buy and come in and want to find an ambiguity in the next phrase or word when everybody's been abiding and living by these since their existence of time, basically. And
weren't there, I'm sorry, it appeared they were arguing there were issues with the 40-foot setback from a boundary, not just on the front part of the road-facing part of the lot, but also on the sides.
With respect to the construction of the Stratmeyer's home, there's some arguments as to if that could be built as planned within the setbacks.
I mean, with regard to other property
right. owners. The other properties, there were violations that they alleged. I don't believe any were 40 feet. They all had to deal with the houses on the corners. So the houses that have the 33 feet that goes into the middle of the roadway, so it could be on the front of a house, could be on the side of another house, especially the ones that are on the corner. You'd have that additional 33 feet into the road. On either side, there is a road. And I see my time's expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Claiborne. Before you start, Mr. Mrazorek, I was so distracted at the beginning by where everybody was sitting that I failed to introduce Judge Rank, who's sitting with us this morning, Sixth Circuit judge, and she's sitting in place of Justice Kern, who recused herself in the case. So with that, Mr. Mrazorek, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Court, Mr. Claiborne. You know, I'm going to summarize basically the appellant's argument is basically summarized in one question asked at trial. That was Mr. Peters, who had three different violations the court found. I asked him, well, so you think it's okay for some people to violate the covenants but not others. Is that your contention today? And Mr. Peters responded, yeah. Look, they have argued that they're grandfathered in, that these covenants don't apply, that they can interpret the covenants to apply because that's who lives there and those are their friends and those are their neighbors. And essentially, the interesting thing about the argument of the appellants is their entire argument is defense. We admit that Stratmeyers have a covenant violation. And essentially, the only covenant violation of Stratmeyers that's still in front of this court would be the setback question. If you look at the briefs, they don't challenge the court's legal interpretation as to the conclusions regarding the waiver issues concerning the city of Somerset. And, you know, this area is not in Somerset. It's one lot away from Somerset, and there's no question, and there was never a challenge in front of the trial court that Somerset platting applied, Somerset notice provisions under that are done pursuant to Chapter 11.6, SDCL Chapter 11.6, the notice provisions they do, were all done appropriately. It was never questioned. The trial court took judicial notice of that. So this kind of red herring of Somerset and the subdivision, he hasn't even preserved that issue for appeal. If you look at his briefs, there's no mention in the original one, and he went through his four issues that he listed in his original brief. There's no mention of a lot subdivision.
Are there property owners within the subdivision who did not commit violations?
Yes, there are some.
I kind of thought, maybe I'm counting it wrong.
Of the parties, I believe the Chief Justice was correct. I think in the plaintiff's side, there was two there was not found a violation. There were, and as to the other non-parties, we pointed out one violation of one non-party on that.
And what I'm driving at is, in just interested in your thoughts, it seems like this is an all-or-nothing proposition. All of these property owners are capable of enforcing the covenants, or none of them are. Is it that simple? Is it possible that within this mass of property owners, there are property owners who don't have violations, so equitable concerns wouldn't apply? And maybe there wasn't a finding that they knew or waived anything. Is this a case where maybe we need to drill down a little more discreetly into this group of property owners, or can we just treat them all as one big group? They either win or they lose as a group.
Well, so these are all equity cases, and you know the court made some equity determinations here, and I appreciate the justice's question because You can look at these. All these covenant cases are different because all the covenants are different, how, where the subdivision is, how many lots are in the subdivision, what's the violation. These are all, it's a really factual, intense determination to get to the equitable determination of what should be done in this situation. So the court went as far as to say, look, this is a one-page set. This is a one-page covenant, has five basic and somewhat vague restrictions. Then in 1976, the area's changed a lot. You have multiple violations. You have 70% of the lots violating the covenants in one way or the other. And the court made it, went as far as to say, look, in, what I get the justice's question to mean is, could the court have just said, hey, as to you plaintiffs, you can't enforce it? But what the court also determined in its conclusion of law is, look, lack of enforcement by you can be a waiver of your enforcement in the future. The example could be, I live in a subdivision for a number of years. I've become friends with everybody. The chicken craze comes in. All my buddies, yeah, you can have chicken coops. But then somebody moves next door to me that I don't really know. He puts up a chicken coop. I don't like the chicken coop that close to my house, by, so I sue him for violation. In those situations, I may have never violated the covenants, but the fact I let everybody else do it, who are my friends, my buddies I've lived with for 20 years,
did the court find that every landowner had waived enforcement or had failed to enforce?
The court,
every landowner knew that there was a violation, and every one of them had failed to enforce the covenants.
The court found there had been never any enforcements of the covenants. The court found pervasive violations throughout, and there had never been any enforcement.
That may all be true, but that doesn't answer the question. Did he find that every single landowner knew there was a violation and chose not to enforce? The fact that there hasn't been enforcement doesn't mean that, the same thing.
There was no evidence presented at the trial by any of the landowners, any of the plaintiffs, besides the two of which I had to subpoena. So the court didn't make that determination because there wasn't that kind of information.
So if you have a landowner that never committed a violation of any of the covenants, much less all of the covenants, and never failed to enforce, it's not proven that they knew there were other violations that they chose not to enforce. What's the equitable argument that they can't enforce covenants now?
Well, the question would be, if you have pervasive, it's like the collateral estoppel, quite frankly, Justice, is if I'm a person that sits there with enforcement and we have multiple parties come in and try to enforce against me, and then somebody comes along later and says, I didn't even know it was a violation, I want to enforce now, and the court's already made a determination, then you can run into an equitable argument of collateral estoppel. Did the court go too far by saying all the covenants are out, or should the court said, as to the Stratmeyers, I'm going to find those unclean hands of the people that have come. I think the pervasiveness and the low number of lots, the court's decision made absolute sense to remedy these situations. As to your direct answer is, the court didn't make that determination because not even all the landowners or plaintiffs or parties.
Another aspect of this, I'm glad you brought it up, this is a broad decision.
Yes.
And it will bind just by its terms and by the language that the court used in its findings and conclusions. It will prevent non-parties from enforcing covenants under the theory that was imputed to everybody. So let's just say, theoretically, as Justice Myron said, there is somebody who moved there, or there could be somebody who moved there at a particular point in time, wasn't aware of these violations. They could have been pervasive. It could have been all over. They didn't know about it. They're too new, or they just didn't know about it. And they weren't being cheeky. They just didn't know about it. They didn't commit any violations. Before there's an effort to preclude everybody, parties and non-parties alike, don't you think court were, and maybe the record isn't set up that way, but doesn't that level of uncertainty seem appropriate?
So I will go back to the number. You have 70% of the lots in violation here. And I think the court determined in a small subdivision where you have so many lots in violation to allow people to enforce certain covenants against the others.
It's a critical mass theory.
Yeah.
We get to a point and it just tips over. But I'm not sure that that's equity as to individuals that might be impacted by that.
It's an abusive discretion standard, quite frankly, Justice, and I, having heard the case and having sat and listened to the witnesses and listened to all the testimony, I understood where the judge went with this, and this made sense. It wouldn't have necessarily made sense, let's say it was a subdivision of 150 houses where it's you might have violations over only in one corner, but these are violations throughout. And that's an equitable weighing, and the judge thought that's how far you have to go with it. Now, the court could have certainly decided, look, the Stratmeyers, there's unclean hands against people trying to enforce, Ms. Stratmeyers can move forward. And the unclean hands issue, as I said, is really only this setback at this point. It's a bit confusing the way the appellant lays out the brief, because as I've said, he doesn't really attack Stratmeyers. He basically comes in and almost says, well, Stratmeyers have unclean hands, so they can't come after us for these violations. Well, that's not how it works. If you're going to enforce the covenants against me, the question is then, is there an issue with your ability to enforce the covenants? And in all frankness, this argument that the lot line is the middle of the road is not factually or legally correct. The testimony at trial by the surveyor, who's the only professional expert called, said you don't pay taxes to the middle of a platted road. These are all platted roads. These lot lines, the boundary of the lot is what the covenants say. There is a true boundary of lot, and it does not include the roads, as testified by the surveyor. Frankly, if you look, and I will tell you, the copy and the electronic copy is a terrible copy. These are oversized. These plats are big. But if you look at Exhibit 16, which in their reply brief they bring up, and they argue, well, Exhibit 16 talks about easements, but Exhibit 16 talks about the easements interior to lots 16A, 6A and 6B, and does not include the road. Those easements are noted as Note 1 and Note 2, and they're utility and drainage easements that are interior to the lot lines. But it is abundantly clear, legally and factually, that these are dedicated public roads, these lot lines do not include the roads, and what doesn't make any sense from their argument is, for the purposes of figuring side lot lines, they say you use the actual lot lines, but for the figures of figuring the front lot line, you use the middle of the road, which isn't part of the lot. Now, the court made that determination. I think that's perfectly clear. I think that argument has no foundation at all. And so the reason that became important is the setback issue within the lot right across the road from this lot has a substantial two-car outbuilding garage and with an additional shed space within that setback, 40-foot setback that they're claiming that Stratmeyers have to do. Mr. Hood has a shed within the setback. The Peters has a shed built into the ground, foundations into the ground within the setback. What he keeps calling a sprinkler house is a 8x10 concrete structure right on the right-of-way. So these are all within that setback, and for them to argue that you measure the setback from the middle of the street doesn't make any sense, even from the standpoint, as the surveyor testified, is the county setback is 25 feet from the front. So that wouldn't even get you out of a county setback if you measure it from the middle of the street. So this issue of the setback, these are all visible, can easily be seen by anybody in that area. Even assuming, though, going back to Justice Salter, your comment of the court, you know, the court looked at also the balance of this and said, look, you got these guys that are violating. Even if you've got two guys that aren't violating, you've got these others that are all violating that are plaintiffs. And am I going to enforce against Stratmeyers but not against the plaintiffs also? And when you balance that equity, he said, you just can't do it. Now, whether there should be a blanket prohibition against further issues on this,
But that was a claim for relief. That was a claim for relief that was made. If you enforce these covenants, you should enforce it against everyone.
That was a claim for relief we made in a counterclaim here, Justice. Sorry, I'm off my game a little bit after asking the final question.
Let me ask this. I mean, do you think it really means that other parties are precluded from ever coming in and enforcing these covenants, not non-parties, that they're somehow bound by this ruling? I mean, you know, you think of res judicata and those kinds of principles. I mean, can the court bind, though? I mean, is that really what the court meant here?
Well, I think the court made a determination that there's so many violations that for anybody to try to enforce them. The difficulty that...
But this is in the context of this case. It's still in the context of this case.
Right.
Can an outsider not come in now and say, you know what, I think all these people are violating it, and I want to stop?
Well,
you think the order precludes them from doing that?
Well, I think the way the order is written now would arguably preclude a non-party with no violations from coming in. I think that arguably does.
And you intended that?
Well, I think that's what the court determined should be done, yes.
Yeah, and that's what you were seeking.
The issue, and one of the reasons you do that, Chief Justice, is there was these pervasive. There was a request made for that, or in the alternative, a request just that Stratmeyer's can continue. May I continue with the final
of
my question? That Stratmeyer's continue. On that, where I brought up the collateral estoppel kind of type issue, you have to be careful on these equity cases, because the next question is, can somebody who's not violated sue Stratmeyer's for the exact same thing? And often in these cases, you don't get 8, 9 homeowners out of 13. You get one person suing one person. Now, if somebody sues me for my chicken coop example that I made earlier, and the court says, oh, your chicken coop's okay, it meets with the requirements, can my neighbor on the other side then, I win this case, then sue you then? And so I think the court was looking to say, look, these issues have been...
But it sounds to me like you're almost saying this covenant, the court essentially reformed this covenant, at least as to these violations. No one can bring those back. How can you do that without these other parties being in that proceeding that are parties to those covenants, landowners?
Yeah, and there may be arguments on that, depending on how they would bring the case. There may be an argument that comes in that says these aren't, like, I would use the term, though the court didn't use it, almost abandoned by everybody, because nobody seeks enforcement, has sought enforcement over the last 50 years. But if maybe somebody brings something, the unique issue in this case was there's so few covenants. This is not a set of covenants where you have 40 or 50 type things where somebody sues just on one, and I find it highly unlikely that court inequity would just say all these covenants are bad because there's one violation out of 30 different things that could happen.
As a result of that court's ruling, do these covenants, do any of them exist anymore? Are any of them enforceable by anyone?
The way I understand the court's ruling is basically says, that they're void. As to the question, Justice, I would be pressed. There could be cases where, going back to the Chief Justice question, if somebody not involved in the case would come in and say, I'm really not collaterally stopped in that situation because my complaint is different.
So Covenant F was the outside appearance of a house being constructed on any lot must be fully completed within 1 year after the beginning of construction. That covenant was not in dispute in this. Is that covenant still in existence?
I agree it was not in dispute with it. I agree that the way the court made the determination is that they found so many violations. I mean, essentially, the court of the essentially five, five
court
issues.
The court didn't find any violation of
they
that
found
covenant.
No violation of that, Your Honor.
So does that covenant still exist?
The way the court's ruling reads is basically saying covenants are no longer enforceable. I could see that somebody coming forward with somebody not completing a house saying that really can't bind me because that was not in front of the court.
So what part of the rationale asserted by the court would support the striking of that covenant, which is not alleged to have been violated by anyone, not alleged to have not been enforced by anyone?
Well, what I believe the court was doing was saying that because essentially all the covenants, of the covenants, the great majority of them were in violation, to try to keep these covenants alive, the court has basically declared them null and void just because they've been, almost like I was using the term abandoned, though that's not the term the court used, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Mazur.
Yes, thank you for the extra time.
Mr. Claiborne, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. This case is troubling for several reasons, and probably the easiest one is these covenants were on record before Stratmeyers did anything. They just ignored them. So the appropriate time when we're talking about equity to have said, okay, are these ambiguous, are these violations, would have been before you went and violated the covenants. Now it's turned into a dog in the manger. You can't eat the hay, but you're not going to let the horses have it. So because you guys don't let me violate the covenants, which I should have known, I have actual knowledge by law. But because I didn't bother to go look and I violated them, now I'm going to go and get the court to find ambiguous the things you've been living by. And that's where I get concerned that covenants become these living documents based on the next person that comes in.
Do you disagree? Do you agree that the circuit court could have, in the exercise of its equitable decision, said any one of these plaintiffs who has violated a particular covenant may not enforce that covenant against the Stratmeyers?
Absolutely, yes.
And do you agree that the court could have made the same ruling with respect to any particular owner that he found knew of other violations and did not enforce it?
Correct. Okay. I would agree with that. And even more to the point, so if you want these to just go away as to everybody, you need to have everybody have the opportunity to be here. They did not bring those parties in as indispensable, but now with this such a sweeping ruling, and I don't want to lose fact that our primary argument is these covenants aren't ambiguous and they're not being broken. But that aside, this ruling is so broad, it has the effect of just nullifying or saying these covenants are no longer enforceable by anybody.
So if this court were to disagree with your argument that the court erroneously interpreted the covenants and that 14 or however many of the other plaintiffs also are in violation of some of these same provisions that are being challenged here, then the status, but we have an issue with the breadth of the ruling because there are some that weren't. What is that? So how does that impact the counterclaim that is then pending with regard to some of the plaintiffs that are in violation, where there is a request to then have them declared to be in violation, those particular plaintiffs as well?
And that would fall under the purview of this court as to whether that issue would need sent back for further decision on how you handle that. Because there are instances, and there have been multiple cases before the court where the court says, yes, that's a violation, and here's the remedy. That goes.
So you agree that if that is how we ruled, then it would go back and then argue about whether declaratory relief and whether all of the other parties in violation
right.
have to abide also?
And that would be it. And the technical point to make is this was brought in the declaratory sense for those issues. It was before everybody went too far that some of these initial things needed to be sorted out. So are these ambiguous? What do they allow? Who's in violation? Who's not in violation? Those things would be appropriately before this court, and certainly if it were remanded back to the circuit court for further consideration. Back to the, I think you know, at some point, once the Stratmeyers in this case opted or discovered that they were in violation of the covenants, that's when they sought to say, okay, everybody else is in violation of the covenants. And to the equitable arguments, that would constitute the unclean hands, where they're coming in and saying, I have a title. Mr. Stratmeyer testified, I had my title insurance report. That report showed the covenants, and I just didn't bother to look. And because I didn't bother to look, now I need to, in order to preserve what I want to do, I need to go and create other covenant violations, which, again, we feel that the facts don't support the court's findings on those. And additionally, we get to just basically say there are no covenants. One of the important issues to also address, I see my time has expired.
You can wrap up your statement you're going to make there.
Thank you. The issue of the covenants was done for a specific purpose. That is, this particular subdivision does not have city sewer water, and the reason for the 5 acres in particular and no subdivision was the fact that those resources will become scarce. Now, with this ruling and with the, I guess, if the covenants are gone, there's nothing to prohibit this from becoming each lot divided into a quarter acre sublots and sold off, which would, again, defeat the purpose of the people that bought cognizant of the covenants. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Claiborne. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.